On today's program, the rapidly changing strategic landscape in Syria, in North Korea, and strong insider corporate head buying in the gold share space.
The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The theoretical future risk is no longer an issue which the modern investor is concerned with. Most individual investors, and listen, I would include professional managers in this as well, they believe they don't have to be early, and they believe that they will not be late. Investors believe things about themselves and their abilities which are quite often not true.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, last Thursday night, I saw that horrible clip over and over and over of people who had been attacked with the chemical weapons there in Syria. And of course, at that time, Trump had sent 59 Tomahawk missiles in to attack Bashar Assad's, one of his military bases. And I have to admit, Dave, I had just a mix of emotions. Part of me was just sick to see that anyone would use chemical weapons on anyone, women, children, men, it doesn't matter. But on the other hand, there was part of me, Dave, that was feeling played. I really did. I felt like something was wrong. I smelled something in the wind that I felt like I was being manipulated.
You know, part of that is, I think, probably the presentation of children's bodies, and that being the primary thing that was looped over and over and over and over again.
Right.
And, you know, you have enough history with media presentation and the idea of propaganda that there's certain ways to stir people.
Right.
And there's certain ways to sort of create a context where the next action or the next prescription in light of what was just seen is absolutely acceptable.
Well, and one of my mixed emotions, Dave, was because I do want to have a president that can take action against
sure.
enemies of the United States. So
right.
I don't want to pull that back either. It's just, it felt weird.
A friend of mine wrote an article in the Denver Post this last week, and he basically said, what's the issue? I mean, are we concerned here that it's chemical weapons?
Right.
Or is it conventional weapons? Is there a distinction between the two where somehow we feel more compelled to action one versus the other? Using conventional methods, the death toll from the Assad regime averages 250 people per day, and that does include women and children. You have 80 people who died by chemical weapons, and somehow we cross a line.
Mm-hmm.
And what he points out is that there's estimates which range from 250 to 500,000 deaths in Syria in the last 5 years. So you can clearly say that it is not human life that we care about. We've already reached somewhere between a quarter and half a million people dead, right?
Right.
And most of that is by conventional means. Somehow 80 and chemical weapons, what does that trigger in us, right? And you have to say, well, what then really is going on here?
Dave, it's like an onion. There are layers and layers and layers you can look at. You know, if we looked at the simple layer, we'd say, okay, well, we took action to punish a bad guy. Then you go a little bit deeper and you go, well, maybe there's a change in United States Middle Eastern policy. Definitely a change from what Trump had said the week before. But you just said something in a meeting we had a few minutes ago, Dave, that I thought was important. Trump is a man of heart. He seems to act on his heart. Now, there may be a lot more going on this, but what I'd like you to do is just expound a little bit on what you were talking to us about, because he is a president that seems to operate from his gut, and this could have been a gut reaction along with a lot of other things that came in through counsel.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think international politics is in some respects like a card game. And, you know, when you sit down, you're playing the cards that you're given, but you're also playing the players across the table from you.
Right.
And to figure out how to read who you're playing is more to the heart of what wins the game than even what you have, because by chance you get certain card mixes, right? And I think that when we imagine the complexity of international affairs and the players at the table, they have to know who they're playing. And in this instance, they know that they're dealing with a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
They're dealing with someone who is very matter of fact. They're dealing with someone who doesn't really have much in terms of a life of the mind, but does operate on the basis of instinct. And so somewhere below the shoulders, he's going to make almost every judgment.
Well, and the difficulty in cards is if you've got somebody who's unpredictable, and he seems to be unpredictable.
Well, he does seem unpredictable. I think what you have with touchstone events, and this may be a touchstone event, is that agendas are driven forward mm-hmm. by touchstone events. So the fact that, again, 250 people die every day in Syria from ordnance and shelling and bullets, I mean, this was actually a better day. If only 80 people died, it was a much better day. But it was a touchstone event in the sense that we get to drive an agenda forward. Is it new Middle Eastern policy and a disposition that sort of contrasts with the last administration? Certainly there'll be some of Trump supporters who have a big question mark hanging over his action saying, look, are we in fact returning to sort of a neocon interventionism, which perhaps we are. But what we certainly have is better political cover. Again, and that's what you get when you roll out images of the dead and you're filled with a sense of horror, both by the fact that they're children and that they suffered before they died.
Right.
So you now have political cover, whereas you really didn't when you're looking at a building that has been imploded because of ordnance and maybe there was just as many people who died, but it just doesn't bring to mind the same visceral response.
So in the Denver Post, Justin, who is a good friend of yours here from Durango, who wrote this article, he was pointing out that there are some anomalies on this or some paradoxes.
Well, I mean, he's a philosopher, he's a commentator, and he's basically saying, look, to the father who's holding his dead child, there's very little difference between shelling and the bullets, which may have claimed a life, or the children in Syria who in last week's tragic events were killed from chemical weapons. And there is the same grief, it is the same loss. I'm not saying that I'm against intervention in certain instances, personally, but to be frank, we can say that this is not about protecting lives. Hundreds of thousands have already died, and we haven't missed a single Starbucks latte. There's nothing in our life that's changed. It's not a crisis until it's defined as a crisis, and now we feel a certain way.
Well, and you do it because of the children, Dave.
Right.
I mean, how many times have world-changing events, or at least the initial phase of a world-changing event, been justified by saving the children?
Well, and maybe the chemical usage is an easier way to, again, sort of bring it home. But, I mean, do you realize that Susan Rice and John Kerry, they've been crowing for several years about the successful negotiations which they had with Russia and Syria, where Russia was going to oversee the complete elimination of chemical weapons from the country? And you have to understand that the State Department, representing the United States and the rest of the world as having created a safer place and Syria a safer place because there's no chemical weapons in Syria following these negotiations, our U.S. State Department looks like patsies.
Right.
John Kerry looks like a patsy.
Well, and Ron Paul is calling this, you know, I told you I felt a little played that night. I hadn't talked to anybody. I just was sitting there going, you know, I feel manipulated. This is a complex situation that we've entered. But Ron Paul, who was a guest of ours, he just outright called this a false flag.
Which is just an operation that's set in motion, not by Assad, but by perhaps a U.S. ally. To further an agenda in the region. I mean, who could that be? It could be any one of the Sunni countries. They certainly stand to benefit from our military action, as does Israel. There's a short list of people who would benefit. You know, a move against Assad is, in some respects, a move against Hezbollah. Assad has been a primary supporter of Hezbollah in Lebanon. You've got Merkel in Holland, who are supportive of U.S. actions. You've got Erdogan in Turkey, who is supportive. And they all stand to benefit from U.S. intervention.
So, Dave, let's just go back and use our memories, because I think it's important to see patterns if this is indeed typical of a pattern. We had World War I, which we said, policy-wise, the United States would not enter that European war. Then we had the Lusitania. We had World War II, which Roosevelt had said, we will not enter that war until Pearl Harbor. And of course, we understand that it was Churchill who got up and danced and celebrated when he heard about Pearl Harbor, because he understood that their interests would be served. Now, good or bad, Churchill understood that America was needed in that region.
Well, it just goes back to the point that agendas are driven forward by touchstone events.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And so, you know, is this one, I guess we'll see. In the ones that we've just mentioned, Lusitania and Pearl Harbor, obviously it was American loss of life, which was a major factor.
Mm.
And politically, that was the justification. In Lusitania, out of, what, 1,100 people that died or thereabouts, I think 10% of them were Americans.
Mm.
You know, this is the Cunard luxury cruise liner. And, you know, the Germans actually justified it saying, yeah, but you were carrying munitions with you. So, you know, they said legally, we haven't broken the rules of war. You're trying to play a different game, whatever the case may be.
But it became a justification, nonetheless.
That's right. So we have disturbing pictures of innocent children. How important was the series of those pictures when they were shown to the president in terms of sort of codifying his resolve and changing his opinion on the matter? Because as you said a few moments ago, he was disconnected and noncommittal on Syria 10 days before, and then he is absolutely, we're going to do it, and he was angry, which again signifies that he is a man of heart. I'm not talking about a good heart, a bad heart, he's just a man of heart. And if he was going to be played, again, like so many people at a card table, if you know how someone's going to react, you've got a good chance of seeing the game unfold the way you want it to. And you're playing the other person. And it may be that he was played here.
Well, and he's no longer a paper tiger. Okay. We now see that he has taken action, and we're going to see the series of events play out from this point forward.
Well, so that's a benefit. I mean, one of the benefits of his sort of unilateral action is that in foreign policy matters, there's people who would say, okay, we understand that he will react. We don't necessarily know how he will react, but we know that he is reactive.
Right.
He's as unpredictable as ever. And I think that's actually a strong position to be in when you're conveying demands or diplomatic expectations.
Who do you think his audience was? Because he was meeting with the head of China at the time. Okay, literally. Gets up from dinner, goes and checks on his 59 Tomahawks, and comes back and lets the leader of Beijing and China know that we've attacked Syria.
While you were sipping on champagne, I just had to take care of a few details.
Right.
So, I mean, the intended audiences could have been Kim Jong-un, could have been Beijing, which would have been very ironic that sort of you're having positive economic discussions. Those are occurring. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Tomahawks are flying. I mean, think about the implicit message there. Isn't it good to be at a peaceful dinner negotiating a way forward for our country? You know, with the subtext all around, isn't it good that we are in a peaceful dialogue on economic reform?
Would you include Russia, Putin on that
well?
Sure.
Yeah, Putin could have been on a short list of who was the intended audience. But Assad, I don't think Assad was a part of it. As Stratford describes Trump, he's now a credible military threat. There's conflict in our house, I mean, with the kids, and that does happen. Just happen almost every day. It seems like almost every minute of the day, some days. When there's a conflict in our house, we talk about what our kids do that either escalates or de-escalates a situation.
Right.
And we escalate and de-escalate are actually part of the vocabulary. We talk about what they do and then sort of what the series of in-the-moment justifications are. You've got reprisals and you've got revenge, and it can go from you took my toy to he bloodied my nose, and it all happens within about 20 or 30 seconds.
And so you don't want it to escalate beyond that.
But it's a perfect case in point of how, you know, things could have been resolved differently, but it was reaction met with another reaction, met with another reaction, with very little thinking involved in the in-betweens.
Well, and sometimes you can determine who wins by who gives approval and who gives warning after an action like this. Now, you've got the European politicians right now, like Merkel and Hollande, who are sort of in trouble. Their parties are in trouble, and it's nice to have a distraction actually away from some of the things going on in Europe.
Right. You look at the approvals of U.S. military action, and you've got Merkel and Hollande, as you say, they would at this point like to associate with strong military action. Look at the context they're in. They're in the context of weak election dynamics for their parties, and they're in the context of a refugee crisis, which has defined domestic political issues for the last several years. Who else is looking sort of with approval? John McCain seems to like the idea.
Well, how do you like John McCain liking the idea, Dave? Does that put a little bit of fear in you?
I've come to so dislike McCain that his approval leaves me feeling like something's very wrong.
Right.
I mean, I understand the motivation of sort of Israeli approval, given the primary regional threats. I mean, you've got ISIS, but other than ISIS in the region, you've got Shia-driven threats, both in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is very much Assad supported.
Right.
And Iran, which is also Shia dominant by population.
Well, and doesn't this placate Turkey a little bit?
And they're Assad supporting. Iran is directly supportive of Assad. So exactly, you've got Turkish interests, which are also served by our intervention. When we can do the dirty work for Erdogan, in Syria, it's appreciated.
Right.
And they benefit massively.
Except for by the Kurds, which I think they're the ones who get trampled under on this Turkish situation.
So. Right. You don't want to get caught in between the rock and the hard place. Turkey benefits massively because you look at the regional issues that they've had, and a lot of the chaos deals with people displacement, refugee crisis there, and that's Syria-driven. So when you think of the comment of Ron Paul's that this might be a false flag, it's not that far-fetched. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of parties that might want to induce the Trump administration away from sort of the nationalist, isolationist predisposition towards action. Right? Dramatic pictures might just move the man to action.
Well, and I'm going to be honest, Dave. Growing up, I loved the old World War II movies where you had good guys, you had bad guys. And I got to be, as an American, watching a patriotic film, watching the bad guys get beat, whether they were the Germans, the Japanese, whatever. And I like that simple explanation. Remember, we were talking earlier that this is like an onion, the outer skin of the onion. I just want to be happy that Trump did something, okay? I want to be patriotic. Doggone it, I just want this thing to stop chemical warfare in the Middle East.
But then when you dig a little deeper, you realize that there's a real conundrum, because if you get rid of him, who's left in his place? I mean, unless we're going to sort of bring in our own man, I mean, is there someone who's graduated from George Washington or Harvard or Yale who we're going to place in power in Syria, right? Because right. If it's the rebels, most of the rebels, you're talking about ISIS, right? So out with the bad, in with the good. Big question mark on
don't
that.
Don't confuse
right?
me with that. What I want to do is I want to go for the simplest explanation first. So give me what you think the simplest explanation would be from an American point of view.
Trump responds emotionally to a series of pictures of dead children and says to himself, we got to get those bad guys. We got to get them.
Right.
And the added benefit is we finally make the press shut up about any connection to Russia. I mean, this is the simplest explanation. You've got political pressure, which comes off of Donald, right? I think that's the simplest explanation.
Right.
Meanwhile, you've got these issues over in North Korea, and Pyongyang gets to view our carrier group being deployed into the region. And you've got Rex Tillerson. I don't envy the man.
Right.
He's got the intriguingly tough job of engaging with the Russians, who maintain a very high level of calculation in their long-range goals, and maintaining some sort of dialogue, conversation, or communication with North Korean diplomats. And Tillerson's got to do this in a very interesting way, because he's not necessarily dealing with rational actors. In the Russian case, very rational, almost hyper-rational. And in the North Korean instance, I mean, it's somewhere between insane and diabolical.
Who knows what that guy's motivation is?
Yeah, to say that anyone has a clear idea of what happens next diplomatically would be a mistake. And here's the fascinating thing. The financial markets continue to flirt with the notion that we live in a nearly perfect world.
Okay, now that's interesting that you'd say that, Dave, because gold has shown its color several times during this incident. Okay, on Thursday, when this attack occurred, gold jumped up $14. Now, it immediately came back down to the level that was at, you know, in the mid-1250s. But just yesterday, gold jumped up in the teens as well, when Russia started saying, yeah, this was a false flag. And when North Korea said, yeah, we're going to go ahead and send a nuke into America if you do any kind of preemptive action. So gold, which we've seen all through history as sort of a crisis hedge, it's showing signs. Now, the financial markets themselves, the stock market doesn't care. I mean, it doesn't care.
No, but the reality is we've been building a base in the gold market for over a year.
Right.
Right. And the market doesn't care about what's in the headlines today. The market is going to do what it does.
Right.
And we can sort of cut and paste headlines into the mix and say, well, it's justified going to 1275 or 1375 on the basis of the most recent market headlines. There's more going on than just North Korea and Syria. These may be the things that are the biggest questions in our mind at present, but quite frankly, the trends are in place. If you said that we've put in a low in gold December 2015 and have been building a base, we've also been putting in a top in the stock market for
right.
the last 18 months. And it doesn't matter what the trigger event is. And we'll all look back in time and say, well, here was the cause. The reason why the stock market went down was blank, blank, blank.
Right.
And you fill in the blank. Okay?
But the top was already in.
But the top was already in. The
okay.
top was in, and we just look for the cut and paste explanation.
But isn't it amazing how emotions completely shade over facts? Because gold and silver have outperformed the stock market this year. Okay. Yet virtually no American is buying gold. I mean, the Chinese are. We know the Chinese, the Russians. We know the numbers are up for the other areas of the world. But gold is outperforming the stock markets. But when you talk to someone, they'll go, yes, but have you seen the stock market?
Right. Mesmerized by new highs, they don't realize that a 4.5% to 5.5% gain in the Dow and the S&P, NASDAQ's closer to 10.
Right.
That puts it still trailing silver by 5%.
Right.
And gold is just under the NASDAQ performance at 8.5% or 9%. So
right.
It is interesting. People see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear.
It's the new normal, though.
What gives us the idea that market practitioners believe we have a new normal and that it is exceptionally good. This last week, JP Morgan's US equity strategist pointed out that short positions, whether you're talking about ETFs, futures, stocks, they were at the lowest levels in 10 years.
And short positions, of course, are when people are betting that the market might go down.
Right. So the other way of saying that is you've got the smallest number of people and bets that the market is going to decline than we've had in a decade.
Yeah, but that's not it. I mean, Dave, the corporate insiders have to report when they're buying company stocks of their own company or when they're selling company stocks. Right now, the guys who run the companies are not buying their stocks.
Right. So it's interesting that Fred Hickey kind of contrasts not only the lack of short positions in the market, right, but also the reality that corporate insider buying is at a 30-year low. So the guys who know their companies and know kind of the prospects for growth in coming years and should say with enthusiasm, because of X, Y, and Z, I'm going to own more of my company. They're not touching their companies with a 10-foot pole. The lowest number of insider buying in 30 years. At the same time, you have no one hedging their bets.
It's the public.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, the public wants stocks. They're buying them on an unhedged basis. Just line that out in your mind. The public wants stocks, unhedged, because they believe the upside gains are there for the taking if you but have the courage to buy. And when should you buy? You should buy now.
Right.
Should you buy it when it's cheap? Should you buy the dip? No, you should buy now.
Well, and even if you ask, what stock are you buying? They'll go, oh, I don't buy stock. I buy indexes.
I buy an index.
Yeah.
So no real hedging, no short positions. Corporate executives who have the best visibility, and by the way, better visibility than you and I do because they're dealing with non-public data for their own companies. They're avoiding their company shares. Lots of selling, of course, is happening, but not a lot of buying by insiders. Can the message get any clearer? Insider buying versus selling, the lowest in 30 years. That should mean something to you.
Well, these guys are seeing the sales numbers, and the sales numbers are not justifying rising stock prices.
Well, it seems like a broken record issue for us to talk about corporate fundamentals and concerns of overvaluation. But you're right. If you look at the sales of corporations compared to the going price of their shares, the price to sales ratio suggests that we have the most overvalued market in all of US market history.
Okay. We're more overvalued if we just look at the sales of the companies that are being represented in the stock market.
Right. Because, you know, you can take earnings and you can include certain things or take certain things out of your earnings numbers, right?
Right.
So you can play games with your earnings, which is why a lot of analysts would say, that's why I like the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio or the 10-year rolling average, because it takes out some of the gamesmanship
right.
that corporate executives bring to the PE game. Compensation packages are tied to earnings volatility. So if you can harness the power of earnings volatility as a corporate executive, you are going to be compensated directly for it, right? And so there is some corruption within the corporate system on the basis of gaming PE. But you look at price to sales and your revenues and your sales. I mean, let's get down to brass tacks. You can't lie about the numbers that are walking in the door or not walking in the door, as
right.
it were. So when your sales begin to fade and the price of your shares continues to go higher, guess what you have? The highest price to sales ratio in all of US stock market history.
That beats 1929, that beats 1987, 1999, 2007, every other crash. It beats it all. It's overvalued. The bottom line is, how much are you selling? If you're a company that sells something, how much are you selling?
Well, investors are ignoring the facts. They're loving the ride. They are loving the ride. And we would argue that a major market top is being put in. You've got the momentum dynamics afoot, which enable rationalization. of investment. And thus we see high levels of margin exposure. We talked about that last week. Record levels, $528 billion, the most recent numbers, never seen before, either as a percentage of stock market capitalization, which gives you the equivalent number going back through all those other periods, or in nominal terms, right? And I guess rationalization. Rationalization is the key word. You might wonder how people get hurt in the investment world and get hurt over and over again. I read gods of the copybook headings last week. The burnt bandaged finger wobbling back to the flame.
Right.
This is it. Making money feels good, and getting off of that train early is a massive psychological task which very few are able to do.
Well, especially if your friends are all making money in the same way.
It's a lot easier to focus on rewards than it is on risk. And so, as we mentioned last week, the theoretical future risk is no longer an issue which the modern investor is concerned with.
Right.
There will be time. There will be time to react and adjust a portfolio. I'll be able to move to cash. I can sell before anyone else does. I can take something off the table, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Most individual investors, and I would include professional managers in this as well. They believe they don't have to be early.
Right.
And they believe that they will not be late. Investors believe things about themselves and their abilities, which are quite often not true.
Well, it reminds me of going to a carnival. The carnival games, one of the things that sucks you in when you're looking at carnival games is it's like, oh my gosh, who can't hit a balloon with a dart, right? So you throw a dart, you hit the first one, start going, oh, I can do this quite a few more times. I'm do it again. But there's things in that game that change where you think your abilities are going to continue to win you that next fuzzy bear, and it's not true. And see, the problem with investing, Dave, you only get a couple of cycles in a lifetime. You only get a few. So, you know, talking to clients who say, I brought them up last week, we lost 40% of our portfolio back in the 2007-2008 crash. We just can't do that again. And I asked him, well, where's the money? Well, we're in the stock market right now, but we just can't lose again. Tell me what to do. I don't want to lose it again.
Strange, isn't it, that there can be long stretches where market dynamics are defined by imagination,
yes,
are defined by hope rather than the reality of fundamentals. So, I mean, just as an example, take Apple. Largest market cap of any company on earth, $760
billion. Well, surely you own some Apple, don't you, Dave?
Well, I own an iPhone, which I'd actually like to get rid of. I'll never own another iPhone in my life. I just publicly stated. No new products in 5 years, with the exception of earbuds.
That's yeah, but those earbuds, deal. I hear they're really great.
Well, yeah. I mean, but they're up nearly $300 billion in their market cap, the value of the company, from its low last year. And yet, get this, sales this last year were off 8% year over year. Their net income dropped 14%. And yet investors love the stock. Investors can't imagine anything less than a $1 trillion market cap.
Right.
Never mind the fact that it's primarily the iPhone that is in a market that's seeing greater and greater margin compression due to saturation, greater and greater competition from competitors. Arguably, Samsung has better products and is delivering to the market sooner, with a few blow-ups along the way, literally.
Yeah, but you know, okay, but on that, you're talking imagination and hope. You said that earlier, okay? And imagination and hope was the justification of the tech stocks going up in 1998, 1999, and it looked like they'd go up forever. They didn't make any sense. I mean, they were worth hundreds of times what they earned, if they earned anything at all. And of course, we had the crash and virtually never saw the recovery of most of those companies.
Well, when reality started competing with imagination, what happened is you saw 60 to 90% declines, both in the year 2000. There was recovery thereafter to the 2007 peak, and then we gave back another 60 to 90% all over again,
right,
with those same shares.
And a lot of those companies didn't exist by the time we got to 2007.
And for the ones that did exist,
yeah,
they're back in force, and you've got Amazon and Google and Netflix.
Well, speaking of Amazon, let's go to the retail spaces, because brick and mortar, everyone's saying, oh, brick and mortar is going to go the way of the dinosaur.
And we mentioned that last week, that there is sort of a retail market carnage going on, that there's closures all over the place, general hemorrhaging in the retail space. And that's, you know, confirmed by Friday's non-farm payroll numbers. If you looked at the number of jobs lost in retail, it was pretty significant. So, you know, Amazon is certainly a part of the equation, but to the degree that Amazon is capturing brick and mortar market share, we are losing jobs, and we're losing jobs in the largest employment sector in our economy. What makes us think, as a firm, that we have something far more systemic than an Amazon explanation, whether it's retail, store closures? We think there's more to the story. Simultaneously, you have a decline in auto sales and restaurant sales.
Yeah, and Amazon doesn't have anything to do with that.
Nothing to do with that.
Right.
So what it suggests is that the man and woman on Main Street have already had to make some budgetary adjustments. Economic reality is or has diverged from market reality. And stocks are continuing to press higher, and your investment dollars are squeezing into fewer and fewer names.
Right.
Again, those are indications of a market top. It's not a broad-based move higher.
Well, and people are borrowing more and more and longer. The auto loans right now, I think, are topping out at historic highs. I mean, it's over $1 trillion.
I spoke with somebody at our custodian on the wealth management side, and this is a person in their late 40s, early 50s, and still paying student loans. Very well-paid professional job, but the deferral. I mean, it's interesting that that debt is still out there. And you're right. When you look at the auto loan industry, there's $1.2 trillion out there. Auto dealers are trying to flex with not only the rise of rates, but also with a dwindling number of qualified buyers. And how do they do that? They do that by extending the payment terms in order to reduce the monthly outflows and help sort of qualify the equivalent of a subprime buyer. And they're running out of subprime buyers too.
Well, in a way, Dave, I mean, they're giving loans until your car becomes a classic. Yeah, it used to be 3 years, and then 5 years. By the time they do 7, 10, 15 years, you may as well just hold on to the car and turn it into a classic.
Well, a 7-year term on auto loan indicates that there's really a lack of fresh meat in the marketplace.
Right.
And this is the same kind of thing that you would expect to see in the mortgage market, where they start going to 40 and 50-year mortgages to lower your monthly outflow and increase the audience of buyers, right? At the same time, we've got the extension of terms on auto loans. We also have a rise in inventories. J.D. Power points out that there are the highest level of auto inventories since July of 2009. Now, let that sink in, because July of 2009, you've got people basically saying, even though the market had turned in March, that was not obvious until 6 months later, right? And you're sitting there in July and everyone's tightening their belts and they're in the middle of the global financial crisis and they're asking the question, do we really need a new car right now or can we put that off? And inventories are rising.
Well, I think that's important to note. You know, we talked about the retail space, but I was a retail manager before I came here when I was in college, and we were very interested in our inventory levels as well as our sales. You were talking about sales being lower, but when inventory is higher, that's also a sign that sales are lower. Now, what I'd like to do is let's continue on the theme of fundamentals, because when you look at a company to buy a company, you look at its revenues and you say, all right, how many years will it take using those revenues to pay this company off? It's a break-even point. And that's another good way to judge the market.
Yeah. I mean, I look at private as well as publicly traded businesses, and sometimes you'll see a privately traded enterprise sell for, you know, 1 to 3 times gross revenue.
Right.
And sometimes they'll be very sort of expensive, if you will, 10 to 20 times in the private market. And those are exceptional, and they're acknowledged as such, exceptionally expensive. But then you get some companies, we mentioned Netflix a few minutes ago, companies like Netflix currently trade at the equivalent of 338 years worth of earnings. Huh. So 338 years from now, I mean, if you went back 338 years ago and said that there was a company 338 years ago that you're just now getting your full investment back,
you're just now breaking even on,
what investment would that have been? What company existed 338 years ago that was still around and you're getting paid off today?
What about companies that don't earn anything?
Right. It makes it a little preposterous. And like Tesla, as we discussed last week, they sell 80,000 vehicles a year and they're failing to make money when the average sticker price on their vehicles is $100,000 per vehicle. And they think that somehow they're going to revolutionize their own business by selling cars for $35,000 a piece when they can't make money on a $100,000 model. It's very, very interesting. Back to hope and imagination.
Well, and last week you said that they exceeded capitalization of Ford.
Ford sells 6.5 million vehicles a year, right? Compared to 80,000. and they make money on every one.
Yet Tesla's more expensive than Ford.
Tesla is valued more highly than Ford when fundamentals take a back seat. And that's the thing. Fundamentals have taken a back seat, and that's a dangerous thing. Who's driving this?
Right.
Who's driving this? When you are dependent on momentum and no one's actually driving it, of course the car can crash. Of course it can. What does it mean? All it tells you is that you're very late in the cycle. It tells you that late in the cycle means that every day that goes by, we're much closer to a significant cyclical, if not secular, decline in the stock market.
Right.
Quite frankly, after 7.5+ years of growth, a secular or longer term decline, that'd be normal.
Well, okay. But we talk about cycles, and then we've talked about, could we be done with cycles? We've had this Federal Reserve backstop. We've had quantitative easing, not just here in the United States, but we had quantitative easing abroad until, well, I think they're backing that off starting now. But do cycles extend when you have printed money and zero interest rates?
I think some of the things that I want to mention would be coincidental and not necessarily causal, but the month is April. The Fed has been hiking rates since the fourth quarter of last year. This is the first month that our, if you want to think of it as a QE baton, we passed it to the ECB and Mario Draghi. So our QE baton buddy over at the ECB, he is now shrinking the euros spent to buy assets. We're shrinking that by 25%.
We called that tapering. Remember that?
Yeah. But we started to taper and we passed the baton to him and he started bumping up what they spent to buy and monetize.
And now he's tapering.
Now he's tapering. Someone has to print in an economically frail environment or declines in the market occur. If there's not enough printing at the margins of the market, the sell-offs ensue.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be $20 billion, if you're talking US dollars, $20 billion US dollars less floating in the financial system compared to last month. And if you annualize that over the next 12 months, you've got $240 billion, just shy of $250 billion less floating in the financial markets going from here until next April.
So the money flow is like the music on a game of musical chairs. As long as the money flow keeps coming, you are fine.
I'm not arguing for Mario's money games. I'm not saying that he should be doing this.
Right.
I'm just saying that it's a game, like you say, like musical chairs.
What happens when the music stops?
Right. The money flows, the music plays, everyone's more or less happy, then the music stops.
Right.
We have a context in the financial markets for reasonable concern. By the way, you remember last week we talked about the volatility index, VIX? It's up 40% from last week in our conversation.
You had mentioned that it got so low, it's going to have to jump. And so now the volatility index has jumped. Is that some of the fundamental reasons, or do you think that fear is entering the market?
I think certainly fear is more in the marketplace, and there's some uncertainty relating to geopolitics.
Okay.
You look at confidence, and confidence is challenged by many things. Maybe it's geopolitical, maybe it's political, maybe it's an accounting function. Maybe it's like Enron and WorldCom, where something doesn't quite add up, and you discover that, oh, Arthur Andersen was fudging the books for them. Oh.
Well, what about fudging insider information? I mean, the Federal Reserve is supposed to be this esteemed institution, yet Lacker had to step down this last week because he was caught giving insider information in 2012.
I don't know what the critical element will be that challenges confidence, but when confidence is challenged, there is a dynamics change, the market dynamics shift. So you're right. You take the context of reduced monetary largesse, you take corruption, if you want to call it that, inside the Federal Reserve system,
right,
with Lacker stepping down. Yeah. Was it inadvertent? Was it purposeful sharing? The amount of information that Mr. Hilzenrath has, the Wall Street Journal, on a consistent and predictable basis would suggest that somebody is always talking.
Mm.
And if the talking stops, Hilzenrath articles will get very, very dry and boring from this point forward. What it means is that Lacker may be one of many who likes to sort of flap their gums a bit.
Well, and corruption doesn't just exist there at the Federal Reserve.
But we're talking about is sharing critical non-public data with Wall Street guys.
Right.
And they're trading on the basis of that. Does the Fed leaking insider information to Wall Street damage market confidence? I mean, you tell me if that ends up being a material factor. In retrospect, maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, you know, my son came to me last week and he said, "Dad, are you watching what's going on with Susan Rice? This is bigger, or should be, bigger than Watergate."
I know. The DNC has its own insider issues, and it's just, it's interesting. Susan Rice appears to be in this place where, after organizing a surveillance apparatus on the Democratic's political opponent, not for national security reasons, but for political reasons. What are some lessons that you can talk around the dinner table with your family? What are some takeaways? Don't ever assume that what's done in the cover of darkness stays in the dark.
Right. Well, the Bible says that. You don't talk in secret what you don't want to have exposed someday.
I think you've heard it said before too. Don't put in writing what you don't want read out loud.
Yeah.
And I mean, whether it's an email, whether you feel like you have to gesticulate and articulate an idea that is nasty and you pop off a text or an email, remember that it's permanent.
Okay, but Dave, this is just politics. Why do politics matter?
Well, politics matters because the fabric of trust is tightly woven, and it includes every aspect of social life. And if you begin to stretch or tear it in any way, and the integrity of the whole thereby falls into question, then yes, it did matter. Everything mattered. For the market practitioner, everything matters.
Right, right. Well, you know, Dave, then going back, I think it's good that there are corporate laws that say, if you're an insider and you run a company and you're buying your shares or selling your shares, we should know. That's a good law. Now, we talked about how insider buying of their shares in the normal stock market is at a low.
30-year low.
Okay. But there is a segment that's buying their shares. Corporate insiders that are saying, you know what? This is a good deal. I'm going to buy.
Right. Well, and, you know, I want to mention a single insider, but also the industry as well.
Right.
And, you know, inside an industry, when an insider is buying aggressively, what does that tell you? Remember that the smartest corporate insiders were buying their shares in 2002.
Hmm.
The market was at a low. Shares were cheap. Saner minds prevailed, and there was a lot of corporate executives who said, I think I want to own it.
Right.
You know, I think I want to own it. And they did. 2002 at the market lows, 2009 at the market lows. And right now, those buyers, corporate buyers, are largely absent. The exception is in the gold space. You've got John Thornton, head of Barrick Gold, former Goldman banker, and he's head of the helm there at the company. He's been buying shares millions of dollars at a time. His most recent purchase, $4 million worth of purchases at about $19 a share.
So he wants to own what he's running.
He's basically saying, if I can buy it at 19, my assumption is I can sell. And these are my words, not his.
Right.
But you don't buy it unless you think the price is going up. Can he sell it in the next 5 to 10 years for $40, $60, $80 a share? Does he think that 19 represents a bargain?
Right.
Yes, he does. How do I know? Because he's putting real money into it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the exception. Within the precious metals mining space, you are seeing purchases by insiders, which indicates that they believe the metals are cheap,
right.
Shares are cheap. If I were you, I would follow not the majority, but the minority. The majority out there would say, hey, I want to own the index funds, stock market's going high and higher, and I have reason for pause. What is that? Price to sales ratio would be one of those things.
Right.
A lack of insider buying would be another. And in the gold space, what do we have on the other hand? You know, they've managed their all-in sustainable cost to levels that allow them to make money even if the price of gold doesn't go up, and that hasn't been acknowledged in their share price to date. So even if the price doesn't go up, there's a value play, and
right.
If the price of gold does go up, all of that drops to the bottom line. Gold and the miners are underloved, they're underappreciated, arguably undervalued.
Well, and physical gold itself is unloved here in America right now, but not by anybody else.
Well, that's right. There's people who do seem to care in the physical metal space. Off of the Shanghai Gold Exchange in February, you had withdrawals of 179 tons. That was an increase year over year of 67%. So
Whoa.
A big drawdown, if you will, of the physical metals held at the exchange. What that indicates is that demand for the physicals is pretty strong right now. The Indian market also increased its imports after all of the Modi shenanigans and sort of monetization schemes, changing what can be taken out of banks and what bills are acceptable, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're back on track. We've got 175% increase in Indian imports of gold. That brings them to 96.4 tons for the month of February. These are big numbers. These are big numbers. Russians, they're in the same boat.
Yeah.
What do I conclude? In a dangerous world with unexpected twists and turns, there are no sure bets. There are no guarantees. And there is every reason to hedge your bets and to own a few assets that have never gone to zero.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. We'll see you next Wednesday. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at ICA Gold for our latest updates and market thoughts. You can also follow David at David McIlvaney. If you want to learn more about us or what we do, visit us online at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.